This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. In this week's podcast, Ben Johnson looks back on the market crash through the ETF lens. We highlight two active ETFs we like. Jason Kephart shares a hands-off solution for retirement savers. And Christine Benn suggests a vehicle to give investors a tax advantage. Let's get started. Here are Susan Zubinski from Morningstar Inc. and Ben Johnson from Morningstar Research Services.
Hi, I'm Susan Zubinski with Morningstar. It's been about a year since the coronavirus 2020 stock market crash. Joining me today to talk about the impact of that short-lived bear market on exchange-traded funds is Ben Johnson, Ben's Morningstar's Global Director of ETF Research. Hi, Ben. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've suggested that the past couple of market crashes have actually helped accelerate the adoption of ETFs among investors. How so?
Well, Susan, I think it boils down to two things. The first is really validation, and the second is opportunity. And when I say validation, I really mean validation of ETFs as a concept, as a structure, as a way of bundling different securities, different investment strategies, and passing those back and forth between investors on the stock exchange. It's a concept now that's nearly three decades old in the United States, but one that, you know, up until really the global financial crisis, hadn't been stress tested in a meaningful way. And if you fast forward from the global financial crisis to 2020 and the crisis period we went through early last year, what you saw is that the ETF industry had grown exponentially, that the amount of volume going through the system was really unprecedented. So according to BlackRock iShares data, there were $32 trillion worth of ETF trades that were executed in 2020. That surpassed the prior record from 2018 by more than 40%. So if you think about just the amount of information getting pumped through the ETF ecosystem that involves participants from investors to the asset managers, to market makers, index providers, the exchanges, it's really quite remarkable. And that stress test, that validation, gives investors confidence that this is a sound investment wrapper, that it's an efficient means of consuming investment strategies, be they indexed, be they active, be they somewhere in between, and will naturally lead those who might have been somewhat skeptical of the vehicle, who had been hesitant to use ETFs in their portfolios, to maybe jump off the fence. So I think validation is an incredibly important element of what we've seen, those tests that we've seen in the past two market crises. Now, the other thing I mentioned before is just simply opportunity. If you think about all of the investment capital that's out there, all of investors' hard-earned money, some of it is to varying degrees stranded. They may have large taxable capital gains that they would realize in certain market environments if they were to sell down their positions and reallocate to an ETF. What those drawdowns, like we saw last year in the markets, give investors the opportunity to do is to actually, in some cases, realize losses and switch to new investment vehicles. So ETFs have benefited from those opportunities in the market that have happened in brief moments in recent history. And what we've seen is that actually the ETF sponsors themselves have been aggressive in marketing those as opportunities for investors to move away from mutual funds and towards ETFs as their vehicle of choice.
So Ben, how would you say the ETF market has changed over the past year?
Well, I think the ETF marketplace over the past year is really just been a continuation of the ongoing evolution that we've seen now over the course of really decades. What we've seen is that there is an ever larger number of participants, an ever larger number of investors that are using ETFs in new and in different ways. The ETF, by its nature, is a very dynamic vehicle, being an exchange-listed and exchange-traded vehicle. An individual, an investor, can hold an ETF in their portfolio as a core allocation. An institution or a high-frequency trading firm might be turning over a position in an ETF every other millisecond as part of some sort of arbitrage trading. So as that ecosystem grows, as the number of use cases grow, as the number of participants grow, it makes really the entire ecosystem, the entire environment, more robust. And ETFs have, I think, long since moved from being kind of the new kid on the block, this outsider, this misfit, and now increasingly have become mainstreamed, have become integrated into the plumbing of financial markets, and are no longer on the outside looking in. And I think that's ultimately to the benefit of all investors in ETFs, irrespective of their time horizon, their use case, or the amount of money that they're bringing to bear.
So lastly, Ben, do you think there's a market event that could happen that could dramatically alter the trajectory of ETFs? You know, where are they headed?
I would have a hard time imagining a market environment that would alter the current trajectory. I think, again, if anything, what we've seen in these crisis periods is that growth and adoption of ETFs has really only accelerated. And I think it'll accelerate further still as the menu of different underlying strategies and active strategies in particular that are made available to investors in an ETF wrapper continues to grow. I think this is a secular trend that is still in the middle innings. I think there's a lot of runway ahead for this category. And there's a lot of runway ahead because investors are realizing that the benefits of the ETF wrapper in consuming all forms of strategies in this format are real, they're meaningful, they're material, and they benefit investors, which is something I think one should celebrate.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your reflections today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
I'm Susan Javinsky with Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
Expand your investing horizons and look to the long term with Morningstar's podcast, The Long View. Join hosts Christine Benz and Jeff Patak as they talk to influential leaders in investing, advice, and personal finance. Search for and subscribe to The Long View today. Now, Ben Johnson and Susan Javinsky look at the active ETF landscape.
Hi, I'm Susan Javinsky with Morningstar. Fidelity recently launched ETF equivalents of a few of its actively managed mutual funds. Joining me today to talk about the state of the state of active ETFs and to share a couple of his favorites is Ben Johnson, Ben's Morningstar's Global Director of ETF Research. Hi, Ben. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
So let's first talk a little bit about how big of a role active ETFs actually play in the marketplace today, and how have investors embraced active ETFs?
Well, Susan, today actively managed ETFs play a limited role in the overall ETF market, and they were relatively late to start. So while the first ETF, SPY, was launched in 1993, the first actively managed ETFs, which were actually launched by Bear Stearns, didn't come to the market until 2008. If you fast forward to the end of January, what we saw is that there are now 500 plus actively managed ETFs on the menu in the United States, and they combined account for about $193 billion in assets under management. So that's roughly a fifth of the overall number of ETFs and a relatively modest 3.5% or so of the trillions of dollars that are invested in ETFs.
What would you say are some of the newest, or let's say the most noteworthy, actively managed ETFs?
Well, I don't think there's any arguing that the most noteworthy actively managed ETFs in the past few years have been the ARK family of ETFs. Kathy Wood and her team at ARK have delivered absolutely mind-bending returns for their investors. Across the board, what we've seen is double-digit compounded returns, putting them really in the record books by virtually any measure with respect to how those funds have performed since their inception. And investors have taken notice. That family of funds has taken in over $28 billion in net new money through the 12 months ending in January, and that accounted for 40% of overall flows into actively managed ETFs in that period. It's gotten to the point where Kathy has become a global sensation. Recently came to light that she's earned herself the nickname Money Tree amongst Korean investors. This is a phenomenon, I think, unlike any I've ever seen within the asset management industry. You know, Kathy's become sort of the Beatles of you know, the ETF ecosystem, which is really just pretty remarkable, pretty incredible. Now, moving on from noteworthy to new, you had mentioned at the onset, Fidelity has come into the space in a more meaningful way. Now, Fidelity has actually long been a player in ETFs. They actually launched a NASDAQ ETF, ONEQ, O-N-E-Q, years ago, but only more recently meaningfully invested in this space, first launching a series of individual sector-focused ETFs, subsequently some factor-focused ETFs, and most notably, perhaps, and most recently, little siblings, ETF siblings, non-transparent, actively managed ETF siblings of some of its flagship strategies. And the latest it added to its stable was an ETF version of Fidelity Magellan, which has just come out in recent weeks. So a very meaningful development, if for headline making purposes, if nothing else, that Peter Lynch's former charge is now available to investors in an ETF format. Other newsworthy developments of late have been Dimensional Fund Advisors' entry into the ETF space. DFA had long been a holdout, had its toes on the edge of the pool, and finally jumped in feet first late in 2020. If you look forward to 2021, it's notable that the firm is actually going to convert six of its tax-managed mutual funds to ETFs later this year. And then last, but certainly not least, we've gotten news recently from Capital Group, the firm behind the American Funds range, that they will be entering the ETF space with a lineup of active non-transparent ETFs of its own. They made a big hire on the ETF front, bringing Holly Frams to BlackRock. Holly's got a tremendous resume, a tremendous amount of experience, has seen the ETF industry from a variety of perspectives. And I take that as an indication that Capital Group has been very thoughtful and is very serious about entering the ETF market after being a holdout for a very long period of time.
So, Ben, what should investors who might be thinking about pursuing active strategies in the ETF wrapper, what are some of the pros and cons they need to be aware of?
Well, the pros, I think, are clear and they're meaningful. First and foremost, the ETF wrapper is simply a more tax-efficient means, a fairer means of delivering actively managed strategies. The way that money moves into and out of ETFs is fundamentally different from how cash moves into and out of mutual funds, and it's to the benefit of all shareholders. Those frictions that are created by investors coming and going from the fund in an ETF are turned inside out. They're externalized. They're paid by people as they're buying and selling. That includes transaction costs. That includes, most notably, the tax costs involved in buying and selling those portfolios. Because ETFs can send securities out of the portfolio in kind without actually liquidating them, in order to meet redemption requests, it means they've tended to be much more tax efficient relative to mutual funds, which oftentimes have to sell down positions to give shareholders their money back. ETFs can also be more fee efficient. So if you think about all of the different costs that are embedded in funds expense ratios, ETFs tend to strip that down to the cost of manufacturing, the cost of portfolio management. What get cast aside are things like marketing and distribution costs, as well as certain shareholder record keeping costs. So the ETF format is going to be a more cost-efficient means of consuming these strategies. You also have to think about it from the point of view of buying and selling as an individual shares in the fund. So most ETFs now trade on a commission-free basis across major brokerage platforms, whereas some mutual funds will still charge ticket charges, commissions, when buyers and sellers are transacting in those fund shares. So those are real and meaningful pros. The other pro I would add is just access. Investors can access ETFs in investment amounts as low as a single share, whereas investment minimums on many comparable mutual funds might be much higher. So this really democratizes access at an institutional price point for a larger number of investors who are interested in, you know, these particular strategies. As for the cons, you know, the chief con, I would argue, is that the portfolio managers themselves lose certain latitude that they might have trying to apply their strategy in a traditional mutual fund. One way in which they lose a degree of latitude is that in the case of actively managed non-transparent ETFs, they cannot invest in securities that don't trade at the same time as the fund itself. Now, this could ultimately change with time, but this is somewhat restrictive to be limited in your investment opportunity set to just those things that are trading at the same time your fund is on a US stock exchange. The other, and I would argue the more important limitation that managers face in operating an ETF, is that they lose an all-important tool in their toolkit when it comes to managing capacity. So what we've seen over the years is that many savvy managers know when they've got enough on their plate, when the next dollar coming in the door would potentially diminish the efficacy of their strategy. They'd have to add that dollar to positions that may have appreciated in value and no longer look like compelling valuations. They may have to allocate that next dollar to their next best ideas, which could also risk diminishing the efficacy of their strategy, hurting their performance. So an ETF can't close. It can't do a soft close. It can't do a hard close. It can't tell investors, sorry, but we can't take your money right now. And going back to the example that I shared earlier with the ARK family of funds, this is an area of potential concern because that particular family of funds now is taking on, in some days, billions of dollars of new money from individual shareholders. Investing in smaller names where it has already very concentrated stakes and asset bloat, as we've referred to it historically, is a real risk in that instance.
Okay, Ben, let's name some names now. How about a couple of actively managed ETFs that we rate pretty highly at Morningstar?
Well, I have a pair for you. And what I would stress is that, you know, what we like about actively managed ETFs is what we like about all investment strategies, be they active, passive, in between, be they delivered to investors in a mutual fund format, an ETF, a separate account, you name it. We look really at those key pillars that support the Morningstar analyst rating. And notably, in the case of actively managed ETFs, we want to understand the process being employed and the people who are implementing that process. Those are two key drivers of our rating in the case of actively managed strategies. So two of our favorites in this space, I'll share one from the world of stocks and the other comes from the world of bonds. The first is the Avantis US Equity ETF. The ticker for that one is AVUS. We've assigned it a Morningstar analyst rating of bronze. Now, Avantis is a firm that was stood up by former DFA co-CEO Eduardo Repetto. And Eduardo has subsequently brought over a number of his former colleagues from Dimensional Fund Advisors to basically build what I've referred to as DFA 2.0. Avantis's strategies have shared DNA with DFA. They look to improve on DFA's secret formula in certain ways, but the commonalities are really leveraging the wisdom of the market first and foremost, and then tilting towards factors, towards different sources of return that have shown that they can outperform the market over long periods of time. So in this case, one of those factors, the all-important factor that's been missing in action for some time, is value. So AVUS is a great option to look at for broad-based exposure to U.S. stocks that has tilts towards relatively higher quality, relatively cheaper names from that universe. The second fund is the PIMCO Enhanced Short Maturity ETF. The ticker there is MINT. Now, Jerome Schneider and his team at PIMCO are a known quantity to our group. They've been very successful over a very long period of time, and especially so in this particular charge, which is focused on the very short end of the yield curve and was originally designed as being effectively a money market substitute of sorts. And indeed, that's how many investors have come to use that particular fund. We have a high degree of confidence in that team. We have a high degree of conviction in their process. And the fund earns a Morningstar analyst rating of gold.
Well, Ben, thank you so much today for your time, giving a little bit of an update on the lay of the land when it comes to active ETFs and, of course, for sharing those picks. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit morningstar.com/Alexa.
Next, Jason Kephart from Morningstar Research Services shares three target date funds for an IRA.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Investors have until April 15th to make an IRA contribution if they want it to count towards tax year 2020. Should you consider a target date fund for your IRA? Perhaps you should. Joining me today to talk about how target date funds can work within IRAs and to share a few of his favorite target date series is Jason Kephart. Jason is a strategist in Morningstar's multi-asset manager research team. Hi, Jason. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
So let's start out with some of the basics. Let's talk a little bit about what target date funds are and how they work.
Sure. Target date funds are designed to be a hands-off total portfolio solution for retirement savers. Most target date funds start off owning mostly all stocks and then gradually become more conservative by adding bonds as the target retirement date approaches.
So why are target date funds something that people should be thinking about for their IRAs? Are there particular types of people who should be considering them?
Using a target date fund is kind of like putting your retirement savings on autopilot. It's for investors that don't have a lot of time to spend on investing. The target date portfolio manager takes care of everything from setting the asset allocation to selecting and monitoring the underlying funds, and also rebalancing as necessary to make sure that the risks don't get out of control.
Now, Morningstar rates target date series and target date funds, and you're very involved in that process. If people want to evaluate a target date fund or series for their IRA, what are some of the things you think they should be looking at?
Anytime you're weighing your investment options, the first thing you have to consider is the fee. The good news is target date fund fees are pretty reasonable considering they're designed to be your entire portfolio. The biggest driver of the fees is what kind of underlying funds they use. The ones that use all index funds tend to be the cheapest. The ones that use all active funds tend to be more expensive. And the ones that use a mix of index and active funds tend to kind of fall in the middle. The other thing to consider is how much stock does it own at the target retirement date? This is arguably when your nest egg's at the most vulnerable. And because you're not going to have any more contributions coming in, you also don't have any more time to make up for losses. So the average target date fund owns about 40% in equities at retirement, but that can range anywhere from 55% to less than 20%. So making sure that that level of risk is something you're going to be comfortable with at your retirement date is definitely a key consideration to keep in mind.
So Jason, let's talk a little bit. Let's name some names and get into some of our your favorite target date funds for an IRA wrapper specifically. Let's start out first with an all index option.
Cheap and simple is a hard combo to beat when it comes to investing. Fidelity Freedom Index totally achieves this. It's one of the cheapest options you can get with a low minimum investment, and it achieves very broad diversification using only a few index funds. One of the things we particularly like about this index-based series is that it uses a long-duration treasury index within its fixed income portfolio. Most index-based peers just stick to the Barclays Ag, which is a good fund, but the long-duration treasuries tend to be a really good ballast in times of equity market stress, so we like that you get a little bit more extra defensive cushion in this bond portfolio.
So let's go to sort of the other side of things and look at an all-active fund choice.
It's no secret that we're big fans of American funds, equity funds at Morningstar. Most of them earn very high medalist ratings, and they've done really well for investors over time. Something that's kind of underlooked, I think, in their target date series is just how well their bond funds work in combination with their equity funds. Their bond funds tend to act like bond funds when you need them to act like bond funds. And by that, I mean in times like March 2020, when equities are falling out of the sky, their bond funds do a really good job of protecting capital. Some peers tend to try to get extra returns by owning bond funds that lean more into credit risk, but that doesn't provide the same defensive characteristics you really want in your bond fund when your equities are really falling off a cliff. So we really, I think, appreciate just how stable their bond funds can be within the context of their portfolios. And so I think this series is one, if you really want the active management risk, this is a series that will totally deliver that at a reasonable fee for a low minimum investment.
And then lastly, your last pick sort of combines the two, some active and some passive strategies.
Yeah, active or passive doesn't have to be an all or nothing decision. Thoughtfully built portfolios with high conviction active managers and cheap index funds where you don't have high conviction makes a lot of sense. PIMCO RealPath Blend does this pretty well. It uses Vanguard index funds for its entire equity allocation, and it uses its really well-regarded in-house bond funds for the fixed income. It's almost like a match made in heaven.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for your time today. I think you've given our viewers a bit of food for thought regarding what they could be doing with their IRAs this year. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
And lastly, Christine Benz from Morningstar Inc. discusses the tax advantages of HSAs with Susan Jabinski.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Tax season is here, and one way that taxpayers may be able to reduce their tax bills is by making a contribution to a health savings account. Joining me today to talk about the ins and outs of these contributions is Christine Benz. Christine's Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance. Hey, Christine, thank you for being here today.
Hi, Susan. It's great to be here.
Now, the deadline for making a contribution to an HSA for 2020 is April 15th, just as it is with an IRA. So can anyone make a contribution to an HSA?
No. So you need to be covered by a high deductible healthcare plan, and it needs to be a qualifying high deductible healthcare plan. So not all high deductible healthcare plans are automatically qualified to be used with a health savings account. But if you were, you are able to make a contribution. One hitch though, Susan, and people sometimes run into this, if you're covered by Medicare, you are not eligible to contribute to an HSA. So just bear that in mind if you're Medicare eligible or already covered by Medicare.
So let's go over what the tax benefits are if you are in fact covered by a qualifying high deductible plan.
Well, there are three, and they're really great tax benefits. So the key is tax-free contributions going in. So you're making pre-tax contributions if you're contributing to your employer-provided health savings account. If you are contributing to an HSA on your own, you're able to deduct that contribution on your tax return. That's what's called an above-the-line deduction, so it reduces your adjustable gross income. So tax break on the way in. If you have the money invested in something and it produces income, you don't pay any taxes on that income as long as the money stays inside the HSA. And then so long as you use your withdrawals to cover qualified healthcare expenditures, those monies are also tax-free. So really tax-free every step of the way, provided you follow the rules. And that's one reason we often say this vehicle is unparalleled in the whole tax code, because you don't get those three tax breaks with any other vehicle other than an HSA.
So Christine, what are the contribution limits to an HSA, and can you make a partial contribution?
Yes, you can make a partial contribution. So I'll get that out of the way first. For 2020, assuming that people want to try to get a contribution in at the last minute, the contribution for individuals covered by an individual high deductible plan is $3,550. It's double that if you have a family plan, so $7,100 for 2020. And like with IRAs, we often see those numbers go up a little bit from year to year. So for 2021, it's going up to $3,600 for people with single only coverage and $7,200 for people with family coverage.
So we're specifically talking about HSAs or health savings accounts, but there are also flexible savings accounts. If an investor is going to, you know, put put a contribution into an HSA, can he or she also contribute to an FSA? And what are the differences?
Yeah, really good question, Susan, and a common point of confusion. So if you are covered by a high deductible plan, you're contributing to a health savings account, you are limited to what's called a limited purpose flexible spending arrangement. So you can use an FSA, but that FSA can only be used to cover dental and vision expenses, basically. So I think that there is an opportunity for people who really want to take maximum tax advantage of the health savings account to also use the FSA to kind of carve out a fund or an account where they will fund it to the level that they know they'll spend on vision and dental expenses in the year ahead. So I do think there's an opportunity to use the two vehicles together. And you probably would want to think about doing that if you have any vision or dental expenses at all or expect to have them. And you also want to try to leave the money in your HSA so that it can roll over from year to year. The key distinction between the two type of vehicles from my vantage point is that HSAs, health savings accounts, you can get those monies invested. You can put them in mutual funds, ETFs, get the money invested and leave it there, ideally, because the money rolls over from year to year. You don't have to liquidate the account each year. With a flexible spending arrangement, usually you do have to spend those funds on a year-by-year basis. People often say it's use it or lose it, and that's largely true. You might have a little bit of a grace period. So you want to be careful not to overfund your flexible spending arrangement because you can't generally carry the whole account or the whole amount of assets you have in the account forward.
Now, if your employer offers an HSA, is it generally a good option for you to take it?
Well, it's definitely more seamless because you'll be able to contribute to the HSA rather painlessly just through your payroll deductions. And it's also seamless from a tax standpoint. So you don't have to go to the extra step of deducting it on your tax return. If you're not covered by an employer health care plan, if you're buying your own health care coverage, you will have to deduct your HSA contribution on your tax return. But I do think it's important for people who are covered by an employer plan to do their due diligence on the quality of the plan, because definitely these plans are not created equally. I think they've gotten better, but you still have some very high cost plans. You have plans with a lot of transaction fees along the way. So do your homework. If you determine that your employer provided plan is not that hot, well, you have a workaround and that you can go ahead and contribute to it and then periodically transfer to another HSA of your own choosing. So you can have more than one HSA up and running it at any given point in time. So I think that's kind of a neat strategy. You're not captive to your employer provided HSA. You do have some wiggle room.
So if you do want to pursue that strategy and seek out an HSA on your own that you could funnel this money into, what should investors be aware of or looking for?
Well, one thing I think that they should pay attention to is that Morningstar has begun rating the biggest health savings accounts. So annually, we've been taking a look at these accounts, and we have been looking at them from the standpoint of two major use cases. We know that people either use their HSAs as kind of spend-as-I-go type vehicle where I'm pulling money from it to cover my healthcare costs as I incur them. So we look at HSAs from that standpoint, and two different HSAs came out on top in the 2020 look at HSAs. Fidelity's was a top performer, as was Lively's for people who intend to use their HSAs as kind of a spend-as-I-go vehicle. For people who want to try to wring the maximum tax benefits from their HSA, Fidelity's also came out on top from that standpoint. But definitely do your homework. Look at fees. If you're using the savings account option, look at interest rates. They're all pretty low right now, but presumably they'll change a little bit and maybe get better in the future. If you are investing, you definitely want to look at the quality of the investment options.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for your time today and helping us navigate the HSA landscape. It's an interesting area for those of us who do have access to one.
It is, Susan. Thank you so much.
I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.